And in truth, in perfect truth, his soul is actually, even in 100,000 million prophets, now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddhist truth one over ourselves.
Buddha, Dharma, the Sangha. Yesterday I talked about the first verse of the Sandokai. Today I'll talk about the second one. The poem begins, from west to east, unseen, fled out the mind of India's greatest sage, and to the source kept true as in sullied stream is clear. Then it continues, although by wit and dullness the true way is buried, yet it has no patriarch of south or north. In some ways, the second verse mirrors the first. It just brings it in its historical reference closer to the time of in which Great Master Sakito Kisen was writing. The historical reference in the first verse is to the time of the Buddha and the flowing out from west to east, from India to China. In the second verse, the historical reference is to the time when there's a great division in the Chan or Zen schools of Buddhism. The China itself was divided into a northern and southern empires, northern and southern political regions. And Zen followed suit by dividing into northern and southern schools. There ended up being some pretty bitter squabbling between the two, between some of the adherents of each branch. The northern school came to be called Gradual School, and the southern, the Sudden School. Like so many of the arguments and divisions in religion, when one looks back at it, it's hard not to wonder what all the fuss was about. Once again, however, there's a lot more going on here than just the historical references. We take the first line of this verse, although by wit and dullness the true way is varied. Another way of putting this would be, well, let's grant that at least at the more superficial level, some people seem to have more of an aptitude and others a little less of an aptitude for not just what we call Zen practice, but for what Zen practice is really about. Which is really listening to and following our own hearts. So in this first line, the poet, the master who's writing this, is acknowledging this fact. Yes, this is the case. It's also the case that in the spiritual life of any one individual, there are times when we raise the eyebrows of the Buddha and the times when we do not. There are times when we listen and follow our hearts. There's times when we don't listen very well and when we don't follow very well. And the consequences of our actions in both cases help reveal the real spiritual groundedness or lack of it, of those actions. Yet acknowledging this to be the case, that sometimes we get it right and sometimes we don't, he goes on to say, yet it has no patriarch. The true way has no patriarch of south or north. Why does he say this? It's more than just a pot shot at the squabbling. Just as in the first verse, it ends with the statement, that the transmission stayed true to the source, as an unsullied stream is clear. So in this verse, after making allowance for acknowledging the differences, he regrounds us in that which lies beyond all the differences, that which includes and transcends both getting it right and not getting it right. And this is the deeper meaning of this statement. It has no patriarch of south or north. The true way has no patriarch of south or north. It's beyond better and worse, right and wrong, good and bad, deeper and less deep teaching, deeper and less deep practice. Getting it right sometimes magnificently and sometimes stumbling once again on the tripwire of our own humanity. The true way transcends all of this. And there's no one who can claim, I've got it, I possess it, I have mastered it. I remember in my early years of being a monk, so many times thinking, well, I'm starting to get the hang of this. And of course, the next thing that happens, what's the next thing that happens? You fall flat on your face. Over and over again. till gradually you just stop keeping score. And just do the best you can in the circumstances. So when we can train like this, just do the training of this day. With a heart that is upward looking, as best we can do it today. Some days, some periods of time, it's so much easier to look up than it is at other times, other days and other periods of time. This is true for all of us. Some days, our own humanity is right there all the time. Some days we seem to have a little more perspective, a little more groundedness. Perhaps now and then a lot more. This is all part of the process. None of it is outside the way of the Buddhas and ancestors. There's no part of it that we're justified in despising, looking down upon, in ourselves or in others. And if we ever do look down upon something else in others, it is because we look down upon it in ourselves. As I have been sitting with this verse, what keeps coming up is just that the eternal cannot be pinned down. And just a reminder of how important it is to get things the right way up in our viewpoint. The hardest thing for people to do is just get out of our own way by making room in our minds and our hearts, in our point of view, in our understanding, above all in our faith. Making room for the role of the eternal in our life, in the process of training itself. Zen is famous as a school of Buddhism that, a branch of Buddhism, that has a strong history, a long history of cautioning people about getting stuck in, fixed in the external forms of training. And yet there's no school of Buddhism, no branch of Buddhism that has made better use in the past and today of the very same forms of training. Some people have thought they were following Zen when they rejected the forms of training. But that's just goofy. A true follower of Zen, a true disciple in Zen, reveres the forms of training and makes good use of them. And is careful not to mistake the finger pointing to the moon for the moon itself. We sit in a formal meditation position in a meditation hall, so that we can actually meditate. And it's the actual meditating, the spiritual act, that matters. What is the meaning of that spiritual act? What actually is it? Well, it's contemplative prayer. It's opening our heart to our own true nature. It's opening our will. In faith to our own true nature. It's giving our body and our mind into the hands of the eternal. So it is not that we must clock this amount of time sitting in a meditation hall, and that having clocked that time, eventually some magical enlightenment is going to happen. Is it sitting in the meditation hall with the right intention and with the right effort is, for most of us, very helpful for the actual spiritual surrender that we so long for. This is true of all the other aspects of our practice. We're not doing magic. Nor are we being adherents of a sect. We're disciples of the Buddhas and ancestors. We're just following in the footsteps of a fine Zen master, as great Master Dogen so beautifully and truly put it. We do these things that we call practice or training so that the Buddhas and ancestors, so that the eternal can help us naturally. Not so that we can be spiritual super people, or so that we can be virtuous, or for any other externalized reason. So you could say another way of putting the verse that I'm talking about today is very simply, although sometimes we get it right, sometimes we don't, the externals are not what really matters. Keep your faith in what is real. Keep your faith in your own heart. And remember that in doing what we call Zen training, we are just doing the best we can, living the finest life we can to be true to our own heart. I certainly hope that all of my disciples will always treasure, value the forms of our training. After all, I'm spending a lot of time here talking about a very few words from a scripture that is many centuries old now, and a very short poem that we recite over and over and over. A poem that I always feel when I recite it, so often feel, you know, there's something I just don't get about this. How many thousands of times have I recited this now? And there's still something really essential in this that I just don't get. But if I have that thought, and I often do, it always seems to be accompanied by another thought, which is like just the other side of this thought. And that is, what a wonderful scripture this is. How wonderful it is to be able to know and to recite this scripture. These two don't stand against each other. And all of our forms of training are like that. Anyone who thinks they've mastered meditation doesn't know themselves very well. Someone who's had the great privilege to meditate enough to know just how much meditation can help them, that's someone who knows something of Zen.